Okay.
So what we're going to be doing today is to talk about games in education. There are different ways to do this, and since I'm not really the hardcore gamer, I'm going to be doing it in more of the academic way, talking about some of the things to think about, some of the surrounding factors and some of the frameworks that you're going to be operating within. And then I hope that you have some experience with some relevant games. Did any of you read any of the papers? They've been on Fronter, mentioned on Fronter. Did you read any of the papers that we're going to be? Okay, no. Well, so maybe the discussion is for later then. I have some points for discussion, but maybe the most of the discussion is going to. Sorry? First week. I hope that I'm going to be covering all of this in 2 hours, so it can be done by the end of the day. I think we should. Yeah, I think we should. Because it's not going to be very long. It's just an hour and then we're done. Yeah. Okay, sorry, that was for the streaming watchers. It's irrelevant. So what I'm going to be talking about is started by some of the theories for learning altogether, for education, teaching, learning altogether, and that is the zone of proximal development and scaffolding. I don't know if you've heard any of those terms, but they are good to keep a reference to those. We're going to talk about learning styles. Hopefully you did fill out some of the questionnaires for the learning style. And have an idea where you are in that landscape. The most important things we're going to talk about in this part of the course is alignment. Alignment, alignment, alignment. That's the really big thing when it comes to educational games or games for education. And we'll talk about games for assessment because I think Simon and I have been focusing on two things in games for education. One is the alignment, and the other is you can't just change the way the students learn about the thing. You also have to modify the way you assess the outcome. Because if you just change the way they learn, then the assessments is probably going to measure the wrong thing. It's not going to measure what they have been practicing and exercising. So that's why the games for assessment paper is in there. Anyone heard about the zone of proximal development? So the idea is that here, these are the things you individually know. This is the things you could do. I mean, if I asked you to program a C++ program, you would all be quite confident doing that. If I ask you to program a functional language, you may not know what functional language is. But that's within what you could do with some help. You could do functional programming, most of you. If I ask you to sing the national anthem when the NFL opened their Super Bowl, none of you would ever do that. That's far beyond what you will feel like doing. So we have this kind of, this is what we already quite happy could do. This is too far out. We can't do that. And in between, that's where we have those zone of proximal development. It means that we can extend the things we can do into this area. We can't jump up here, it's just too far of a jump. But we can jump in here, in this zone. That's where we can possibly develop as students or as professionals. So this is, and the interesting thing is that this is not a fixed size zone, so this is individual. So for some like big challenges, they can make big jumps. Others like more things that are close to the comfort zones and close to what they already can and know. So this is where, when we make games or any educational activity, we would like students to get out here because here they won't learn much. This is where you're going to learn. but it needs to be either very close to here, or they need increasingly more guidance, increasingly more help. And that's where the idea of scaffolding comes in. So here, they don't need much help, but the further out, the more help they need to manage. So probably, if you remember back when you learned programming, you didn't learn object-oriented programming and the advanced concepts as first thing. You need to get slowly through this and get gradually. But if you have a course where you want the students to get, even in the programming course, you want students to get exposed to some more difficult concepts, like I have in the database course, I have all the students do, the first thing to do is to make a blog. They have never seen a database before, never interacted with a database before, haven't seen PHP before, and the first thing I wanted to do is to make a blog. And how can you do that? Well, I give them a sample program that does the same thing, but for a very different case. And they can look at this sample program if they want to. If they need scaffolding, they can look at the sample program and mimic and copy and do it the same way. If they don't need it, it's fine. If they need it, they have some help. They have provided them some help to make it easier to reach high up. So the idea of scaffolding, and this is, you know, from games, you have this increase of levels. That's pretty much the idea of scaffolding. So you need help in the beginning, but as you get more skilled, that help is just disappearing, and you are on your own, and you need to manage the challenges by yourself. So that's what we, those are the two things we need to think about when we make games for education. We need to try to assess where the students are and how far up we want to get them to reach, and then how we make this so that we have some scaffolding in the beginning and we take away more and more of the scaffolding, so more and more they can deal with the advanced concepts by themselves, and they get that. And by removing scaffolding, they get more the sense of mastering, being able to deal with bigger challenges, and they can feel that themselves. Okay, so how would the levels in computer games be related to zone proximal development? You have been playing games with the meta levels. Is it relevant? Is it related? Because? Because what's happening is that as you learn more, this one is increasing. I mean, the what you can do is increasing, and then you get higher up that. Okay, so let's try it. Are there any disadvantages of scaffolding, then especially in games? I think it's you're absolutely right. It's by scaffolding you remove some of the possibility for the player or for the learner to go through the challenges in their way. Because scaffolding, you would typically prepare one given way through the challenge levels, and some players, some students may prefer to go a different way. And if you really like to be and have the like to be challenged. You're motivated by big challenges, and you really like to master things yourself. Then scaffolding will be feeling like you are kind of restricted and bound a little bit. So it's not always the answer isn't, and that's I think is to most of the things we're going to talk about today. There isn't always a good a one answer that is correct in all cases, because you have a variety of players, variety of students, a variety of courses, a variety of issues, and it's pretty much a balancing act. I think Simon talked about that before as well. It's all about balancing challenge levels, so that the learning styles. There are quite a few learning styles. We're going to go through some of them, not because I want you to remember the details of all these styles, but what I would like you to remember would be kind of the dimensions, kind of the axis, kind of the balancing points that we need, because as I said, Simon was talking about balancing games in general, and now I consider these learning style models, there are many axes that we need to think about and we need to balance. We're going to come back to that. I'm going to talk a little bit about learning style issues, and I put up a paper. I'm going to reflect a little bit on the paper, because it's not a perfect paper, but at least it gives you an introduction to the learning styles. So I'll talk a little bit about the papers. And if you read it, then you probably have some comments as well. Now the first one, this is the paper. The learning styles and training methods, and they gave a literature review and did a survey of some students' preferences when it comes to the VARC style. But it's not, the results of the paper isn't as interesting as the description of the learning styles, so we'll start there. And then we have the Felder-Silverman model. That's kind of an extended model. It includes a couple of more axes that I think is relevant to think about. So hopefully by the end of the day we have an idea of what are the axes that we may think of when we design educational games. So this is the Kolb's learning style model. And I'm sorry that it might be a bit chaotic, but it's not as hard as it may seem. On one side you have what they call the processing continuum, and that refers to how we do things when we learn. Do we like to experiment actively? Do we like to do things? Or do we like to watch? Do we like to look at... So I'm a climber. So when I have a hard move, I want to learn something, a new challenge, get a new challenge level in climbing, I may want to try it myself over and over and over again, or I may look at videos of the good climbers, how they do it, and study. How do they twist their legs? How do they use their knees? Where do they seem to push off? Or do I want to try it myself and get a feeling for it? So that's one dimension. And the other dimension is, do I like to... It says feeling here. I would like sensing better. It's not just about feeling. It's about sensing. So do you like to be in the situation and sense, or do you like to think about this? In climbing, do I really want to hold on to the holds and try the move, or do I want to close my eyes and think about it and visualize and reflect and think? So those are kind of the two axes. Are we thinkers or doers, or those who like to really sense it directly through the senses? Are we those who like to do stuff, or do we like to watch others play, others do stuff? How do we learn? And then we have this kind of circle that goes through these. So, for instance, when I want to try something that I can't do in climbing, it doesn't matter where I start. I may often start here by thinking about it. How would I want to do that? I'm thinking about it. What do I need to do? And after thinking about it, I'm going to try it. And as I try it, I'm going to feel whether it worked. I mean, when I fall off, I know I didn't do it. So I could feel that it's too hard, I can do it this way, and then I go back and play with it. And maybe somebody else is recording me on a video camera, And I can look, and I can look at how I did it. I can reflect on what I do and why it didn't work. And based on the reflection, I can start thinking again, okay, so what do I need to do differently? And I can try it. So there is a kind of a circle in learning. We typically experiment, we test something, and we get a kind of a feedback, a sense for whether it's right or wrong, and we reflect, take a distance view of what happened, look at the video, look at others doing it, we reflect, and then we think about it, make some conceptual model, some aha, this is the way it needs to be, and then we can test this. So we go through this circle. And based on this, they have the Kolb defined four different types of learners. So for instance, me, I'm more of a thinker, so I may think and do, so I think this is the way it should work, and I try it, or I may think and watch, so I may look at other climbers and see, and then see, okay, that's what they do, so this is what I need to do. So being a thinker, I could watch what other climbers do, I can think about what I need to do, and I can try it. If I'm Simon, I think is more of the sensing guy, more of the guy who is hands-on, and he would want to do something for real, hands-on, and would try it, and sense how it feels, and then reflect on what he experienced, and go back. So often, we tend, or I don't know, were you balanced? You did this, the Hanuman Maharshi is kind of similar, I'm going to come back to that. But were you balanced in all four, or we tend to be a little bit, have a preference? I think I'm heavy down here on thinking. I'm not so much hands-on as I'm a thinker. And maybe you are more on the on doing and less on watching. So some, in many cases, tend to be a little bit uneven. So how did you come out in terms of the Honey Mumford, which is kind of similar? I'm gonna come back to that. Were you? You were in the middle, balanced. Sorry. Okay. All over. You haven't done it. Okay, you should. It's quite, and it's kind of frustrating. You have to choose which one you have to choose. You can say, oh, they both apply, but but you have to choose. It's kind of frustrating. And you're
quite far up to the left, the reflector.
Right.
And a little bit more higher up into the
right. Yeah. So, and it's not the thing to think about is that there is no correct, but if you are very skewed, it might be that you would like to challenge yourself in being better at the areas where you are not so strong, and activate that part and challenge yourself. This is just a description of the four types that you get out. Honey Mumford is very similar, but they looked at the stages in learning, which is kind of the kind of circle, outer circle in the Kolb's model. So you have an experience in climbing, for instance, you fall off. And then you start by reviewing, why did that happen? Oh, my foot slipped. Oh, why did your foot slip? Well, I didn't put enough pressure on my foot. Why didn't I put enough pressure on my foot? Well, probably because I was stretching out too much. When I stretch out, there's not enough pressure on my foot. Why did I stretch out? Well, because I didn't. So that's kind of the reviewing you do. And based on that, you kind of conclude, okay, so what I should do is to move my feet up before I stretch out, because I move my feet up, then I have more pressure on my feet and I can move up. And then you try it, and you think about when you come to that place, get your feet up first, and then you try to move, and then hopefully it works. So this is the activist, is the one who is then like to have the experience, the reflector, is the one who is likes and spends a lot of time reflecting on what they just did. The theorist is the one who's trying to say, okay, so now based on this, what should I do differently? What should I try? How does this link to what I already know? And then the pragmatist is the one who's saying, okay, Now we need to take that theory into real life. We need to test it, and next time we do it differently. And these are some of the activities, and this is where you had the test and activist, theorist. You have some kind of axis here, and it's interesting to know where you are. But as we're going to be concluding, I think it's equally important that when we design games, we try to think about, are we challenging all these types of learners? Or are we now making a game that is just for one type of learner? And I think it's in many cases it's useful to have a kind of a variety also in the kind of styles you need to activate. So this is how the activist is the same as accommodator, the reflector very much the same as the diverger, the theorist same as assimilator, and pragmatist the same as converger, using different names for it, but quite similar if you look at the Kalman and the Hummel model. So, any suggestions of where the educational games would fit? Would the educational games be good for pragmatists, theorists, reflectors, activists? Would it change the games if you address one type of them? Did you have any thoughts when you did this test yourself? If you were to do a game, would it? What kind of activities? What kind of games good for actively experimenting, for experiencing, getting feedback and real experience, for reflecting, or for creating your own theories or models or conceptual understanding? I haven't done the real survey, but I would think that you would find that games tend to be up here. There aren't so many games for reflection and conceptualization, although I think it would be very useful. And it's kind of a side effect, I think. I mean, if you play chess, and of course you need to create a kind of a mental model of how chess works, so you could say a game can help in building up some conceptual models and understanding of the world. But I think more could be done in terms of reflection, support reflection, build that into the game, and maybe also the conceptualization. So this would be the easier part, because games are very much hands-on and you get immediate feedback. So it is for making experiments and have the experience, immediate experience of how it worked and didn't work. So that's where the games are stronger than the traditional reading a book and reading an analysis. But it doesn't have to stop there. And I think that as master students, and hopefully some of you would continue to a PhD, this is, since there isn't so much here, this is what you would like to explore. And reflection is important as a student, and having games that would encourage and even give students positive feedback to when they do proper reflection would be interesting. Then we have the VARC model. You did the VARC model as well, which is kind of the boring model to me, because it's just looking at the medium. Is the medium visual, oral, rewrite, or kinesthetic? And I think what games really add here in learning would be the kinesthetic. That's where games are much stronger than the traditional forms for learning. There are labs, biology lab, physics labs, where you do try to set up an experiment and you're kind of getting an immediate feedback kinesthetically as well. But games have typically better ways of doing that. So were you surprised? I was actually quite surprised when I did this myself, because I thought I was very much read-write, but I very much more visual. I should have known, because I always draw models and always explain in images. So I should know, but I kind of thought of myself as a typical read-write. But so were you surprised, or where you ended up?
Yeah,
balanced.
Yeah, I was surprised that I was very optimistic compared to Christian.
Okay. Good. Again, it's an interesting thing to do, and it is what we do know, or at least what you can imagine, is that if we, when we design educational material, if we can activate more of these, not just having to read, not just having to listen, but to activate more of them, of the media or the senses, then it's more likely that it's going to be engaging more students, for one thing, and secondly, that if you have the same input several channels, it's more likely that you're going to be remembering, or the students are going to be remembering. Again, education games might be quite good at the kinesthetic part, but also the visual kinesthetic part. The read, write, and oral is typically something that is less important in the game, but that's where books are really are, and lectures. So, and I think that's another thing with games for education. To me, a good frame of mind would be to say games could add value. It doesn't necessarily replace existing activities, but it comes as an extra value that would be useful for certain types of learning, certain types of material for some students. But it's not necessarily the answer that, okay, let's make a game and then we can stop having lectures or stop having regular courses. So I think it's a good idea to think of it as an add-on that will make sense in many cases. Felder Silverman, in that paper, it's very much overlapping with what you already saw. So you have on one side the sense or think, it's visual or verbal, which is kind of the VARC model. Inductive deductive means whether you like to apply your theories in practice, or you try to deduce new knowledge from what you saw. Are you active or reflective? Are you sequential or global? That's a new axis. So does it mean that you learn step by step, or do you take a kind of a holistic or an overall view, a system kind of view, and try to get the overview first and then you go to the details? So this is kind of a bottom-up, top-down type of thinking. And when I teach, I try to do a little bit of both. I try to give an outline that gives you kind of an overview, sets the stage, and then we go into step-by-step within that picture. But there are many ways of doing this. But thinking of whether you should start by the linear one-by-one, and this is quite heavy scaffolded, if you think of it that way. So if you want to learn this way, then typically the sequence kind of provides you a kind of a scaffold. Well, if you have the more the system-wide, then you let the students explore it on a more overall view, and the scaffolding isn't so present. And there are some other instruments as well. And you tried the Honey Mumford and the VARC already, and you did the player. I don't know, Simon, the player style, if you could say, did you find that surprising, or? We talked about the scores already. So you think this is useful to know? You found it useful to know a little bit more about your, or if you found that you were balanced all over the place, it's probably not so much to learn, but I think it's when you go to college, I think the one of the most important thing to learn is learning to learn, and knowing a learning style will hopefully help you see what is the most effective way for you to learn new stuff, because you will always, as professionals, you will always need to learn new programming languages, new environments, new tools, there will be new challenges, new technologies. So knowing a little bit about your learning style is always good. Maybe you already kind of know without knowing, but now they have a possibility to explore it, reflect a little bit on it. Implications for education, if you were to put it this way. If you look at this from a student's point of view, we talk about, or Simon talks about a lot about the self-efficacy, having the student being in full control of the learning. And as I said, by knowing your learning style and by providing course material in different ways, then students will feel more of being in control and self-efficacy. There has been some, I think that was a wrong way of thinking, but there has been some researchers that are trying to saying, okay, now what we should do is to adapt the content to fit with the learning style of the student to make the outcome the best, to improve the learning outcome. Should we present the material to the student in the style that fits the student the best? And I don't like that type of thinking, because I think learning is more than learning the actual subject. Learning is also a part of development, to develop the student. And if the student is weak in reflection, you shouldn't avoid having the student to reflect. You should challenge the student to reflect more. So you shouldn't choose a style in which he doesn't have to reflect so much. So I think there is also one way of using this kind of tool or these styles is to try to see, okay, if you find that the student has some weaknesses, maybe that's where he needs to work, maybe that's where he needs a bit more scaffolding maybe, but may need to spend more time doing these kind of activities. Of course, we need to think about that zone of proximal development. So if students aren't very good in reflecting, then you may need more scaffolding and they need more more help to find it motivating. But hopefully you will be able to present in a way that will find motivating to work in areas when they aren't strong. And the teacher perspective or game developer perspective, I would say, would be to create learning environments that are kind of balanced. So it encourages development, and also some students would find that some parts are easier for them to understand, and it's motivating to learn some and get that some parts are easier and some parts are harder. But there are some issues here. For one, there aren't very strong empirical evidence of these styles, and they aren't as independent as you would be seeing. You tend to be a mix of styles. It's not one style only. And the question is your preferred style stable over time? Are you using the same? Do you learn the same way now? Do you have the same preferences now as you had in primary school? Do you see a change throughout the course of a study program or the course of activities? And contexts. So is your style a bit dependent on the subject, the type of course, the type of learning? So it may not be, may think of it as something more organic, dynamic than what it may look like from some of the papers. But I still consider it to be a useful tool at, in the terms of a useful way of thinking and useful reminders list. So when you develop course material, then think about, okay, now is there room for reflection here? Is there room for experimentation here? Is there room for watching here? Is there room for more hands-on here? So it can be thought of as kind of a list of questions that you will like to ask throughout the process to see if you address these issues that will be important to at least to some students. So then, how to make use of it? And as I said, should we try to choose the learning style of the student? So in games, I mean, when you create levels, you try to figure out what the player is capable of doing, and as he's scoring more and more on the easier challenges, then you can say, okay, now we can increase the challenge level. But then, what about the learning style? So if you find that this student isn't very good in reflecting, what do? Do you try to activate other ways, or do you try to have them to reflect, but give them more scaffolding? So there, it's a question of how you're actually going to use this, and to what degree are you going to target the learning to the actual learner? Maybe you aren't. Maybe you just say, okay, now we provide that kind of combination of styles, and we support and we challenge all styles. But maybe we do try to put in some scaffolding with some students are afraid of experimenting, maybe they need a little bit of scaffolding experimenting, so they could do some experiments that they can feel are kind of safe in the beginning. So like if you play a game and the player doesn't like to see the player being blown up, then maybe you need to start a bit smoother, and then being blown up is something that happens when you're used to see you're being injured. So because I think it's a short-sighted strategy to say, okay, if we know that this student isn't good in experimenting, trying to just watch others, this is probably a short-sighted strategy in the terms that we are developing students as professionals and as human beings, and if we can help them develop on their weak sides rather than trying to adapt everything to the weak sides, I think that is would prepare them more for the challenges of life and the challenges of being a professional. So I very much believe in that they should be challenged. But again, we need to think about the zone of proximal development, so they couldn't be challenged too much, or the challenges couldn't be too large. Need to be a good progress also in the challenges. So as I was saying, this paper isn't this paper isn't necessarily very good in terms of some of the research qualities, but I did choose it because it gave a good summary of some of the main learning style models, and it does discuss the use and limitations of learning styles. I thought that was good. Now when it comes to the actual study they did, I think they presented the results in an incomplete way, so it's hard to really see what they did, what they didn't, what the results are. And they have results and discussion mixed up in one big soup, so it's hard to reassess their discussions, because it's hard to read the results per se, and it's kind of mixed up, and it's hard to redo and reproduce. I didn't find the conclusions of interesting. Talking about their study on using the VARC model, or the use of VARC model, and they had some conclusions without evidence. So they were saying, without showing any evidence for that, it's also confirmed that the delivery of the training or teaching materials should be done according to the student's preference rather than the instructor's preference to yield better results. And then the question is, what results are we talking about? Results as a future professional, or in terms of exam questions? I mean, so there are, they have some some conclusions that are without evidence, or at least they haven't defined it very clearly, and it's hard to say it is confirmed. I didn't find that confirmed anywhere in the paper, but at least that's what they're saying. So the paper has some weaknesses, but if you read it to get an introduction to the learning styles and to see some of the discussions on the possible use and limitations of the learning style models, then I think you can live with the other weaknesses of the paper. I think we make a break there, and then we talk about alignment and games for assessment after the break. we just start there. So the next two topics of this talk would be first alignment. As I was saying in the introduction, alignment is one of the key things to worry about when we make games for education. And the second one is using games for assessment. But let's start with the alignment. And there are several papers that you could pick up. But the one I chose was the one from, I believe it was from 2010, in which they were looking at aligning game activity with educational goals. And they were following what they call a constraint design approach to instructional computer games. Now, this is in English poetry, so the case might not be all that interesting. But I think that the, and as you were going to see, what they call a constrained design approach is something that's very familiar to us. But it has a very good discussion on aligning game activities with educational goals, which I think is the most important part here. So what they are saying is that there is a main challenge for students' games, and that is that you need to have an alignment between the activity and a goal. So whatever learning activity we design, so if I have some exercises, if I have some lab work, if I lecture, whatever I do when I teach or whatever you do as students, it should be aligned. So if you spend a lot of time doing some lab activity, then that time should be useful in terms of reaching some goals. So there should be some learning outcome, some expected goal that you should be able to manage something, master something that you will be good at after doing that lab. So an education game should help in the students understanding the intended concepts, learning what the game or the course is supposed to give the students exposure to, not just be fun and engaging. So we shouldn't just add some badges and scores just for because it's fun and it's more so the students can have these competitions and that is motivating. It should be something more. When we add any mechanics, game mechanics to an educational game, it should be to make the students better in one or the other areas that's important, that is a goal for the whole course. So the learning experiences, it should be engaging, and meaning that the students, by using a game, students at least some of the students, not necessarily all, but some of the students should find that as an engaging way to approach the content of and approach whatever they're going to learn. And it should be successful from the instructor's perspective, which means that after doing these activities, the students should be better at something that's important, that's a goal for the learning activity. So game activities should also be meaningful learning activities. So if you create a game where the students need to solve some puzzle or some challenge, it should not be as kind of a award for being a good student. It should be that these puzzles and these challenges should be something that would give students some skills or some knowledge that would be helpful to them. So not just add in lots of fun stuff just because it's fun and the students are going to spend more time on it. What's important is that the students spend more time on the activities that will be meaningful to the learning. That's why it's a serious game. It's not just a game, it's not just fun, but it also should have a serious use, and here it's educational use. So in this paper, they talk about three groups of misaligned games. So the first one would be if you just take any entertainment game and you repurpose it. And then you hope that the concepts and skills would be specific, but in general, these are whatever you learn aren't really or necessarily the goals of the activity. So this might be, you might find some overlap. So if you have SimCity, okay, students may learn something about social system evolution, but it's not, they weren't designed with that purpose. And there are lots of activities in that game that has no link whatsoever to the objective of the course in which it's been used. Social systems.
And the right wing were very upset that, when you defunded activities, that people got upset. That was a left wing disparity. People don't really get upset. So they were both upset.
Right. And also one thing I like to stress, and that goes for all types of games, is that game is engaging. Which that's why we introduce the games into education. It's more engaging than reading. So hopefully the students spend more time playing the game than by reading or solving exercises. Now, if that time is mostly spent on gaming activities that have no link to the learning outcome, then it doesn't matter so much that they spend more time, because they don't learn more. They don't spend more time on the learning activities. And with games, there will always be kind of a startup time where they need to just understand the game and the mechanics and the world they are in. So there will always be that startup time, and that startup time couldn't be too long, because then they will need to spend a lot of the time where they should be studying on learning to play the game. And the other is games that are added, so it's a motivation, a reward system. So now, okay, after solving 10 math exercises, you get to play this game and you have some fun. And that used to be quite an approach. I don't know if it's that anymore, but quite an approach is that in some of the earlier education games, you had to do the boring stuff, and once in a while you were rewarded by being able to have a short play session where you could do the fun stuff, and then you were back to the boring stuff. The drill and skill games are would often be this way. In this case, the games were just a way to reward correct behaviors. And there are some games that really distract from the learning activities. Either the games are not very fun. So I think there are the games that are very fun, but you don't learn much. And there are games where you learn much if you did it, but it's not very fun. So educational games are hard. They need to be good education. They need to motivate for good educational activities, and they need to be engaging and fun. And developing games that are fun is a challenge. Developing learning activities that are motivating and good is a challenge. And if you combine them, it's double challenging. So this is the activity goal alignment design. If you look at their what they write there, is that designing for activity goal alignment. So here the idea is that when you design the game, you have the goals of the course next to you, and then say, okay, to reach this goal, this is the type of activity we should have. To reach these goals, these are the type of activities we can have. So we're trying to balance game-like attributes, such as motivation, but the activities of the game are meaningful, and they exist as more than just a means to an end. And then the game includes the motivate-inducing attributes of challenge, proclivity, uncertainty. At the same time, that's directed towards the learning goals. So these aren't just games of the type you saw before where the gaming part is just added as a reward. The game activity is designed deliberately f- for a certain learning goal or a certain objective. So, you have had any experience with the educational games? Tried anyone? Some hands-on experience? What? Right. You like them or? Right. The skill and drill type of. A real purpose of typing, right. Did you find then it was good alignment? I mean, that's a pretty simple drill and scale. So if you're typing speed, then it's easy to make a game that checks the typing speed. So it's kind of a very simple game in that sense. Okay. You're just drilling the multiplication, yeah. Yeah, I think it's good to put on those glasses when you see educational games to see, okay, is it clear what are the objectives or what is the reason for these activities? Because you will find that in many games there are at least some activities that are more or less just for fun. And the idea here in this paper and this way of thinking is that if you could change these activities to also contribute to the learning goals, then the activities would be not just for fun, they would also be useful for the learning, which is the ultimate reason for having that game. So this is what they decided to do. This was an interactive fiction poetry game where students were to read and try to analyze characters and read text and poetry and understand what was the content. So this is what they did. So they looked at what are the activities that we would like to design, what are the game elements, and then what learning activity would that map to, so that when you have these are the goals, so you start by saying these are the goals of the course, and then you say, okay, what are the activities that we would like to have to reach these goals? And then you say, okay, what are the game elements? And how do they link to these activities that are linked to the goals? So you have a very nice and complete in design. So when you design, when you have an idea for something that's fun, then say, okay, now, okay, if it's just fun, we're not going to include it. We like to include something that is fun and contribute to one of these learning goals, and then we define an activity, which is a learning activity, and link the game activity to that learning activity. To avoid that there are lots of game activities that don't contribute, other than being fun and engaging only. So this is why this is double challenging. You need to find these activities that are engaging and motivating and fun. At the same time, they need to support the learning. So this is kind of the design methodology they were using. So they were exploring, what they call informed exploration, trying to understand what this should be, and the enactment is where they develop the system, and then eventually they look at and evaluate and assess what they did. Now if you look at this, you see here that their design is in what they call waves, and this to us looks like an agile process with sprints. So you have an idea, and you test it, or you implement, and you let the student test, and you take the input, and you implement, you change it, and you have the student input, and you test, and you do it. So it's kind of, we would call that an agile process. and that's pretty much what they do. So I think this is in design research. This is typically a way you will be working, in which you start by looking at literature, you start by surveying literature, understanding the needs, you do develop some theories, some ideas, and you design it, and then you rigorously test your design. You have an idea, you know what the purpose is, and you test if you can if you get the results, and if not, you change. And you rigorously you develop and test this into come to the point where you can go into the formal testing and see how well was it now. But so in all steps, you try to do it in a systematic kind of research, as much research oriented as you possibly can. And here then the students get to test the system in various stages and throughout the lifetime of the development. So then there, during the design, they were then trying to say, okay, now how can we use challenges here, or how do we deal with the proclivity and uncertainty? I'm trying to think about that for all the steps of the game, but then, as I said, link them to the learning objectives and learning goals that we had already. So when they were describing some of the challenges, is that when a developer has a good idea for something that's fun, then okay, how can we link that to learning activity? And there was some kind of fight or power struggle when it comes to what features to implement, because there were nice gaming features that developers would like to add, but if it wasn't clear how that would contribute to the learning, then they would have to or they couldn't, they weren't allowed to add it to the game. So it was kind of strict. And I don't think, as always, or as in most cases, I don't think being too purist is good. So sometimes you can allow some elements that don't, as long as it's a good balance and as long as it's within acceptable borders. So if it's if you have a good idea for something that will be very motivating and is not very distracting, and you can't really find a link, but the game is lacking some more spices, then I don't think it's too bad an idea to add a little bit. But being kind of careful and knowing why you include the feature, and making sure that you don't have a lot of features just there for fun, then I think you should be on the right side of that. So idea is to have the gaming activities and the learning activities to overlap as much as possible. Not necessarily 100%. There might be learning activities that are not gamed, and there might be gaming activities that you have mostly for connecting everything, mostly for making it in a nice frame. But trying to make the overlap as big as possible. I think that is a good idea. So the results, they were using this in the 9th grade English class and used graduate students in a game design course as developers. And they were looking at the challenges of balancing gaming and learning activities. As I said, it was always some would like to add some gaming features, had some great ideas about game features, and then how can we fit that into the learning activity? They were trying to... they were seeing that the experienced players, they could really solve puzzles without going through all the required learning activities. So this is something that Simon has been referring to a few times. If you can game the game, if you can really solve the puzzles without the learning, if you can find shortcuts, then it's not good for the learning activities, because it's in the end that's what you like to make sure that the students learn, and if they can just find ways to see some patterns and see ways they can get through the puzzles without doing the work, that they can assure that they know the stuff, then it's not a good it's not a good game. And it's hard to achieve complete alignment. And I could also add, I don't know what Simon thinks about it, but I would add as it's hardly an objective in itself to have complete alignment, because complete is just too much. But have good alignment. I'm really happy having good alignment and what you should say, a well thought through alignment. You know why, in some cases, you have some gaming elements that don't necessarily result in a learning activity. But knowing why we include it and not having too many of them, I think that is just fine. So it doesn't have too much details in the conclusion. So it's studying the game design students, and they do mention a few limitations, but these aren't necessarily so significant as they're trying to do, or as they're discussing them. But the overall, the way of the, if you look at the design process, design, I think it has a good recommendation in terms of line out what are the objectives, the learning activities, the learning goals, and what learning activities we'd like to have, and then how can you use map these to the gaming elements, gaming activities. And if you find some gaming activities that doesn't necessarily link 100%, at least know why it's included and make sure that there aren't too many of them, and so the students get distracted and use too much time on these activities. And no one read the paper, so there isn't much to discuss. Okay. Read it. I think as you will see throughout this course, I know that students, earlier students, former students, have been quite frustrated in that some papers are very verbose compared to what we are used to. So this is in English language teaching, so the paper has many more words than what you're used to. And the amount of content divided by number of words is not as high as we are used to. So you will feel it's repetitive, and I'll get to the point. But still read it. I think it's worth reading it, both because I think this is a very good idea, and it's something to, and the alignment is a really good or an important issue in developing educational games. So I think you should read it, even though, and maybe we can have a discussion later on. The other paper is where you look for game for assessment. And in this paper, they're trying to see how game performance can be used to look at the students' performance in the course. So as I was saying before, it's the game does record a number of scores and a number of or log basically all activity, and that could be used as part of the grading in the course. And rather than having a final exam, you can see kind of game be used. Is the game a good predictor for how well the students would do in the final test? That's kind of the question here. And they talk about motivation, extrinsic versus intrinsic motivators. And Simon talked about this in the first lecture. So we have these extrinsic motivators like the scores, points, badges, achievements, grades, and they can be engaging and motivating, but they tend to be short-lived. And as Simon was saying in the very beginning, they tend to reduce the intrinsic motivations. So if you get paid, as you're saying, if kids get paid for painting and drawing, then eventually you would see that they would optimize the income and not so much doing this for fun anymore. The intrinsic motivators are highly correlated with self-efficacy and long-lasting. So if you can find what is really motivating the students here in terms of learning, and then this is what the games should really be based on. Now, what this paper is suggesting or is trying is to see, can we tie the scores to learning objectives so that the scores that in the beginning, the scores are extrinsic motivators. So you have a scoreboards that is so you can compete and see how well you do compared to others. That's kind of an external extrinsic motivator. Now, if you make the scores as cues to achieve mastery, so the scores are for you to see how close you are to mastering this, not so using the scores as a mean to see how well you're doing, not as something that you compare to others, and you and tying in the scores and make it whatever data that is recorded in game would be a feedback to you on how well you're doing, how well you're mastering the challenges, and not just the score. Then that would be one way to make the game part of the assessment, because then the how well you score in the game would tell you how well you learned what you're supposed to learn. And what they're, this is a newer paper, this is from 2015, and what they are saying is that if you look at the literature, you find that, or even in the marketplace, you find that games are mostly used for the learning process, not so much for the assessment of learning outcome. So in the end, after doing the math game, you go to a math test to show how well you can do math. And the research questions for this paper the game scores, are they good predictors for the learning outcome? Meaning that, so in this case, they were training Levy controllers, or Levies are the barriers in Netherlands they have to stop the ocean from flooding in into the land, and they had patrollers that would go and watch and see if there are breaks and cracks and things that need to be fixed, and they were making a training program, and then the question, these guys would then have to do some tests in the end to see how well they were able to detect problems and solve problems. And now the question is, would the game, how well they scored in the game, would that be a good predictor for how well they would do in the final test? And they also looked at whether having good computer skills would make a difference, because this is all about learning to be a good Levy controller, not whether or not you had good computer skills. So if it would favor those having good computer skills, it's probably not so good. And at the same time, they looked at the younger players compared to older players. But the most important thing here, I think, is trying to find scores that are and align scores with learning outcome. So it's a third or 3D game using kind of a first-person shooter type of interface for Levy patrollers, and these are the learning objectives. So they should be able to observe failures, and they should be quite accurate in finding location, and there are a number of problems they should be able to identify, and they should be able to observe and report and assess. So this is kind of the overall objective of the game. And they had the setup where they had a start meeting, where they did a pre-questionnaire and pre-test to understand how well, or what is the age, of course, of the students, and how skilled they were in using computers. And then there was a demo of the game, and they got to do an exercise. And then they had home exercises. The game, they were supposed to be for at least 2 exercises each week, and it was unlocked in sequence. So they couldn't choose, they were sequenced, so they couldn't work on them in parallel or too close to each other. They would have to follow that the locking and unlocking sequence. And then they had this for 3 weeks. So they had 1 exercise here and 6 exercises here, and then they had the 8th and the final exercise here, and then they had the post questionnaire and a post test to see how well they learned. They had 145 participants, all volunteers. They were employees of the water authorities, mostly male, middle-aged, and not so skilled on computers or games. And 80% completed the training. That's something to think about when you are designing something like this. You won't have 100% completion rate. 80% is probably a pretty good number. So if you want to run an experiment like this, you have to try to get more participants than what you think you need for the final analysis. So learning objectives: the participants did improve their scores, and they did React. So what they had, some pictures, and there were some virtual pictures in there, and they would were able to recognize the problems from the game virtual pictures compared to real pictures from real life that was showing some problems. They found that there was a strong correlation, game score and the post knowledge perception. So they asked them how well they thought they managed and learned, and they found there was a strong relation. And also with the post results. So they asked them how well they were thought they would learn, and they did the post test. And people tend to be a little bit, they're not overstating how well they're doing, so they tend to be a little bit, it's not lack of confidence, I guess, but they don't want to show, they don't want to pretend like they know everything. So they say, "Well, I know, it's okay." But then they scored more, they scored better. So in the actual test, they scored better than what they would say their self-assessment would indicate. And there was a good, very good correlation. And you could also find that the correlation was increasing throughout the exercises. In the beginning, when they didn't find anything suspicious, they didn't learn much. But as they moved on and they learned more, then they scored better, and they felt that also that they understood and learned more, and they scored better. So there was so further into the course or into the training program, they started to recognize more, and they scored more, and they also understood that what they had learned, and so there was a good correlation. In the beginning, it was more like accidental or incidental, that they found something and they didn't feel that they learned much from that. But eventually, as they learned more, they could spot more, and then they got the scores and they get the positive feedback on what they actually learned. And there was there were good indications that the game did train the players to understand where to look for failures. So during the game, they did get some real-world knowledge that would be useful to them when they were patrolling the levees. And there was only a moderate correlation with appreciation of the game. So whether the players really liked the game or didn't like the game, it didn't affect as much what the learning outcome was. So fun for first design philosophy may not be the best, because it's not so necessarily so important to make it fun. As long as they did it and they completed, they learn a lot. Whether they liked it or not, it didn't matter as much. So in these kind of games, the fun factor may not be as important as the developers may think. But again, this is kind of a good example or a good case in which is a some real-world skills and knowledge that you are kind of drilling, and then the students were employees of the water authority, so they thought this would be useful knowledge and something that they needed anyway. So it was kind of good alignment, if you talk about alignment here, good alignment of the game and the actual world they should, or the actual learning outcome and the actual challenges they should be solving later on. I did see a strong relation between computer skills and performance, but I think that and that kind of something to be expected when we deal with or when we use computer games. But what you can assume is that the number of users who are familiar with games are going to be constantly increasing, and the number of users who are totally unfamiliar with the computers and games will be reduced. So this is not necessarily a problem that we need to worry about for very long. And they didn't find any relationship between the prior gaming skills and how good the gamer you were and the performance in this game, because it wasn't very much of a gaming element. It wasn't gaming performance per se, more on on understanding the issues and having the right responses to some cases and scenarios. So in this case, they say that performance is likely not a function of the game experience, but rather a function of computer skills. So to operate and to be able to navigate, you need the computer skills more than game-specific skills. That we can still expect to be the case for some time, but eventually most users will have computer skills. Otherwise, it's hard to do anything these days. So. And there was a negative correlation with performance, maybe partly because of the computer skills, how well they knew about computers, and it may also be that older people learn have a harder time learning and are not going to be performing. So there might be several explanations for that part. So, recommendations. They found that, of course, players need to learn how to play before they can learn from the game. So that's what I was seeing in the beginning, that the players... And this is we're talking about the scaffolding. So should we have more of a tutorial, a guide through, or should they spend the time to explore without... And different players may have different preferences. So some may want to be led through an introduction, and others may just go out and explore and learn that way. But at least we need to think about the intro, how, especially when we have games for education, and players may not be doing this just because it's a game and they have that game experience and they want that whole exploring the game world type of approach. And I don't think we need to worry too much about players lacking computer and gaming skills, because I think this is the fraction of users in that category is going to be smaller. And don't necessarily need to focus on fun first. It may be that if you can align the gaming activity with the learning activities, and you can align the scores of the playing with the mastery of whatever skills and knowledge the students will learn, then that's motivating in itself. So that will give an intrinsic motivation. You don't need that a lot of fun factor, a lot of fun features. Again, we need that conscious decision, design decision. So we need, as we did look at the previous paper, we need to identify learning objectives and then design the game activities and the scoring mechanisms to align very well with the learning objectives and what you would like the students to be able to master. Okay, so you didn't think about the paper, so read it. It's a shorter one. It's just 10 pages and it's quite good. And I think it's a very good example of what seems to be a successful case for these type of games. So, summary. From all the three or the three types of topics that we covered today, I mean the learning styles, alignment, and scoring, if I were to condense this into kind of a best practice, it's probably a not so scientific thing to do because I don't have necessarily the evidence for it. But based on these papers and what you've been reading other papers, I would say that from the learning styles, what I think you should consider is what learning styles your game will be challenging. So I don't know if you have, So think about these, as I was saying, in various dimensions. So are you doing it yourself, or are you watching? Are you experimenting, or are you thinking? One dimension that I didn't include, but Felder Silverman included, is are you doing it alone or in groups? And you have the question, are you
visual and read, or are you audio or kinesthetic? This axis. Are you addressing things in a sequential way or in the global holistic way? So you have kind of different axes. And when you design the game, try to see if you cover which of these axes you cover. Are you just out here? Are you over here? And try to think about coverage. And not all games need to cover all of them, but having a kind of a conscious decision of what you cover and why you cover it this way. And that is to be aligned then with the learning outcome of the course. So if the course is very much about reflection, then of course thinking needs to be quite high up there. If it has a lot of skills, then experimenting is probably going to be high up there. So think about that kind of alignment, but then say, okay, even for reflection, hands-on experiments might be a good idea to introduce and cover that. Alignment, it's a good idea to start by looking at what do we want students to learn? What are the goals of the learning activities? And then you start aligning the gaming activities with the learning goals. And finally, look at scores that the students can consider being cues to their level of mastery. So that when the scores increase, the students have a good confidence that they actually are mastering the subject matter in a better way than they did before. I think this is kind of my overall summary of the three of the papers and what we've been through. And then there are more details that you could go into. But if you remember these three, then I think you have a good starting point for being able to contribute to games for education. Questions, comments, concerns? Would it be more useful to see some good examples of games, or this would give you the basis for analyzing and looking at and playing games?
Did you play Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? I think you're all too young for that game.
No, I think I might have.
Final outcome.
Yeah, and so World War II games often try to do battles within, like they do smaller conflicts rather than have. Like
where on Frontier do you want to go?
If we go to 3OK.
Yes, I'm there.
And we scroll until you get to topics.
So the bottom. There you go.
Scroll down, previous self-contact, please note, short, quick description, there's the lecture schedule, and there's proposed nice presentation topic, and a link to proposed topic. Okay. Fill in your name and send it to you, so go here. So if you go there, it should be a page here with various game topics. So once you email me, Joel, email me that you want to do games for behavior change. We need you guys to decide what topic you are going to do. Now, you can actually edit these, right? So this is the front page, but you know, it's got editable ability. Please do not lock it when you edit it. It's very annoying when people say, like, student goes in and they edit it and they leave it locked for some reason. And then no other student can do it. And then I go in as administrator and unlock it. It's also not synchronous editing, so if one of you goes in, others won't be able to look at the documents, or won't be able to edit the documents while you're editing, right? So it's not like Google Docs, you can edit at the same time, it is very serial, right? So I have some start papers for some of the topics, which are below. So if you hear it, below there is a gamification, so some start papers that I put in for previous years. Those I just kickstarted in that area, right? So rather than the start paper you need, they are suggested. You can also have a look, if you want other suggested start papers, at the list of previous topics on the front page. You can scan down and see the other lectures, the other papers that we covered in the previous year. Those can be a start point. I would like for you guys to help update those, right? But rather than update every possible topic in every possible way, knowing what you are interested in studying and having you choose a topic area will help us make those decisions and update and give you new papers to read. Now, if you can find a paper that you're particularly interested in one of these areas, then that you show it to me, I go, that, I do a quick scan of it, say, yep, that looks great, there's plenty of things to discuss there, and then you put that, and then we send that out, and we share it with GoRed, and we share it on the page here, and everybody gets to interact with it. So I want those decisions, I like those decisions made this week. So if you guys can put stuff in there, and if you know what topic you're interested in. Now, initially I didn't know if I would be back for next Thursday, because we leave on Tuesday, probably afternoon.
We'll have to see how much setup time we need.
Yes.
Because it's going to be Wednesday afternoon, so it is probably possible to leave early and come back the same day.
Are we training or carrying? Or busing?
Because
there aren't really any really trained equipment.
By plane, in that case. If you were to do one day trip, it would be one plane. But we can have a look and decide.
So I will have the potential of being here on Tuesday and Thursday next week. So I would like to add the Tuesday lecture and do my games for help and then start immediately on the Thursday with you guys presenting. Right? So this is going to be a week from now. Otherwise, I do the standard Thursday lecture and then you guys have decided topics and we hand out the lectures and the papers to read for the following week on Thursday.
I think that if you're interested in education, I mean, it's possible, even though we had a brief introduction here, it's possible to go in depth. So if you're, for instance, if you want to go into STEM, science, technology, math type of courses, you could do education for STEM courses. So there's, even though it's not listed here now, doesn't mean that we covered everything that can be said about games for education. So, but a bit more specific would be useful in that case, I think.